Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening. I'm Ruth Anna Marce Theo, and this is Gather Round. So, in the U.S., even if you're not in the U.S., you probably know that Texas, the state of Texas, has several, shall we say, fanatical or right-wingers, supposedly Christians. And I just saw that they are trying to get covenant marriage written into their platform somehow. So truly, the state seems to be so backward. I am amazed. Hopefully, there's enough people there with their heads out of their butts to prevent some of the ideas these fanatics have. But I want to say, also, this is an exciting time. In 2 days, Friday is Friday the 13th, and, you know, that happens occasionally. Well, this is Friday the 13th full moon. So I would say do something a little special just to celebrate it, because the next full moon on Friday the 13th is going to be in 2049. So that's quite a little bit ahead of us. And also, along the same line, I forgot to mention last week, but last Saturday, Mercury went retrograde. Remember, that usually is for about 3 weeks, and it means that transportation and communication are a little rough. So if you're going someplace, give yourself a little extra time. If you're thinking about any kind of contract, you know, we always say, well, read it over and have somebody else set it up. Well, read it over several times. Try not to sign contracts during this period. And we do have them like 3 times a year. So it's good to know when. And sometimes you just can't avoid. You can't avoid traveling. You can't avoid the contract. You do the best you can. But just be aware that things sometimes don't turn out like you thought they would. And before we get into the interview with Mimi Soltysik, I just have one more thing. When we're talking about simplicity, and you know, I do that here frequently, I don't want people to think that saying you can't have beautiful things around and things that you really enjoy. I know that I'm probably going to have to be, because I've got a couple new art prints, and I'm going to have to rotate wall hangings, because important as pictures and things are, the negative space is also important. So today it was hammered home to me what a great idea it is, if you're nailing something, to hold the nail in place. Now, I'm not talking about doing carpentry work. Probably wouldn't, you know, that's something different. But if you're just nailing something here or there, hold the nail in place with the clothespin. It's wonderful. You don't bang your thumbs and fingers. I swear, this will work for you. So, on that happy note and sore thumb, for many of us who have suffered from that, I'm going to go right into this interview. Now, it was recorded a couple weeks ago. We thought it would air before this, but it's airing in time. Mimi will be talking about an event coming up this coming Tuesday. So, and we don't know what happened. The audio on my end could have been better, but you will be able to hear him just fine. So, without further ado, here we go. Mimi, you're going to have to pronounce your last name again for me, because I have a problem with it.
It's Soltysik.
Soltysik. Yes, okay. And where can we find you online?
Well, you know, you can go to the Socialist Party USA's website, and even if you just in your Google or, you know, whatever, if you just type Socialist Party USA, the party's website will pop up. But the actual address is socialistparty-usa.net. And, yes. And actually, this the Socialist Party has an eco-socialist commission, and we have a website as well, which is strikeclimatechange.org.
Okay. And that was where the this event that we're going to talk about comes from.
Right.
I get it. Okay. So you've been in the Socialist Party for a while. You're very active. You are, I believe, the male chair of the Socialist Party USA, and you're the chair of Socialist Party of California.
That's right, yes.
Right. So just briefly, how did you get involved in the whole socialism? What do I say?
The movement?
The whole party, everything.
Sure. I think I reached a point in my life where for such a long period of my life, like I was just sort of a glutton. And it was just, everything for me was just take. And I played the band for a long time. And it just, everything was sort of focused around, you know, fun at, you know, any cost. And I think I, you know, finally reached a point where it all felt so, it started to feel sort of, I guess, vacant or empty. And Lynn told me about the female vice chair of the Socialist Party. She and I started to, in Los Angeles, we started sort of an activist group, and we would do things like organize bicycle drives for children in South Los Angeles. We did some clothing drives for victims of human trafficking. And as we were doing our work, I think, you know, we started to realize with every one of these, I guess, it would almost seem like a band that you'd try to apply, like 10 new sores would pop up. And it started with your cancer. So, you know, we started to really do research, and while we've always been, you know, I think sympathetic to the socialist movement, but really do research into where can we put our efforts to start to try to attack the cancer versus sort of the mandate approaches. And spent some time doing research, searching different organizations, different groups, really looking for something that was sort of anti-authoritarian, that there was a lot of room for, you know, personal freedom and that sort of thing. And also that had sort of a warm and friendly kind of atmosphere. So I've done a lot of research, talking to people, chose, you know, the Socialist Party. Just seemed like a good fit for us. And after meeting the people there, meeting the National Secretary, Greg Payson, and just the experiencing how warm and friendly it was and how the patient.
You're breaking up just a tiny bit, Mia. You're breaking up.
Okay, can you hear me better?
No, that's better. You were talking about how warm and friendly the people were when you met them in person.
Oh, sure. And I think, you know, the party stresses democratic participation. I don't think I was aware and what exactly that meant until I got there and I realized that none of our institutions do we sort of have the benefit of democratic participation. You know, your family is hierarchical, your school is hierarchical, your workplace is hierarchical. And when we first joined the organization where that participation was sort of expected, it's almost like taking a breath of air for the first time. Like, gosh, do I even know how to do this, you know? And then
right.
Once you get a taste of what, you know, like, you get a taste of what that's like, it's kind of profound. And so, you know, at that point, it was just sort of like, gosh, I feel comfortable. I feel fulfilled. And there was just an integrity there that I was looking for. And since then, it's just been a blast. I mean, the work is very hard, and you know, as you know, the country has, although it's waning, I think, you know, there is sort of this, you know, something. It's either hostility or skepticism with regard to socialism. But I'm finding, you know, with each day that passes, it seems like it gets a little bit easier to talk about. It gets a little, the reception is a little bit warmer. So I think that we certainly have so much work to do, but I think that the climate might be changing a little bit. And that's inspiring. I mean, it's sort of, each day, okay, let's hit it.
Right. Because, and I heard people just a few years ago, maybe even a few months ago, would have, you know, poo-pooed the whole socialism idea because, you know, it was ingrained during the Cold War and different, you know, about how horrible communism is. This is what our country taught, which, you know, it was one of the many lies we were taught. And so people are unhappy enough now, many, to start looking for alternatives. They're seeing that this capitalism isn't working.
Right.
And so it is easier to mention things and just point out things without beating people over the head. But they're much more things. So it's really
I agree completely. I think also, you know, one thing that's happening is that as more people, you know, as they have access to the Internet, they can fact check in real time so that if somebody feeds them a line of bull, they can verify, is this accurate? Is this true? So, you know, a lot of the propaganda and a lot of the spin about, you know, socialism, communism, et cetera, people find out, you know, right now, well, what are the facts? And I think one thing that's been very helpful for us is that now, because the facts are all readily available, we can almost say, look, you don't have to take our word for it. Just look at the facts. And generally, if people are willing to take a moment to do their, you know, do a little bit of homework, then they'll come back and say, okay, I didn't know that, or I'm surprised, or why weren't we aware of this? And there is reason to be hopeful.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's what keeps you going, I think.
Yes.
Just when somebody says, okay, I get it. I know what you were talking about. You were right. I looked it up. Or it's just like, wow, that does make sense. And you say, okay.
Sure.
Like you say, you get out of bed, it's like, okay, forward. Now, you said that the Socialist Party has, I want to say like an off-branch or something, called the StrikeClimateChange.org. You can find that information. And
that's true.
Now, is that the national, is that the Socialist USA, or is that the California part, or?
That's USA. So in 2011, our national convention passed a resolution that said the party had to develop a plan of action committee that had to survey party membership, and by the 2013 convention, they had, after surveying party membership, had to locate what were the four issues or so that party membership felt that the party as a whole should be focusing its energies on and sort of waging campaigns around. So one of the four was eco-socialism. So in 2013, at the convention, commissions were organized, focused around each of these four issues. One is the prison industrial complex, one is labor, one is anti-war, and one is eco-socialism. So the Eco-Socialism Commission came together, and I think there are about 16, 17 people in the commission, and started to get to work, started to lay out an agenda. What do we, you know, what is it that we want to do? What sort of contribution can we make when we look at sort of our capacity as a commission? And how do we strategic plan? So the first issue that, you know, we came up with a statement of purpose, and then we decided it was very important for us to locate educational materials that our membership could access easily. In addition to our membership accessing easily, where can we house this information in a way that the public could access this information as well? You know, we certainly want to extend far beyond party membership. So sure. We, you know, we located the information that we thought would be a good starting point, and we sent that to all party membership, housed it on the national website. So after that was done, then, you know, we started to, you know, talk about, okay, what can be our first step as far as a campaign contribution? And that's how we eventually settled on this June 17th strike climate change, this boycott. You know, we got the website, we set up an event page on Facebook, and this will be the first in a series of actions, you know, throughout the course of this commission that we undertake.
Right, and it is on a Tuesday. You know, a lot of actions like this are for the weekend. So, Mimi, would you explain why it is a Tuesday?
Sure. I think the impact, it is during the work week. One thing that it can do to help, we included in the statement for this particular event calculators for a carbon footprint to show that what your impact, you know, people are on a work day, they've got to, you know, they have to face the transportation issue. How do I get to work? What alternatives do I have? How can I minimize my carbon footprint? So we included that in the message to show that, well, if people rode a bike on this particular day, what sort of effect does that have? So it really presents like an educational opportunity, an awareness-raising opportunity to show what sort of contribution you can personally make on a day when you're normally reliant on, you know, fossil fuels for your transport.
Right. I thought that's the reason, because we know, I mean, so many fossil fuels are used up. I mean, it's horrible. Years ago, they did carpooling. I think it was
sure.
Required. In fact, that's when I started making some blow-up dolls that people would put in their cars if they didn't
yes.
want to carpool, and so it would look from a distance like they had an extra person. But that was pretty much required, carpooling there for a while. I don't even know when that was, but I've heard about it. And so now we don't have that, and people are back to just single driver going to work.
Right.
Using all this, and so I think this is excellent that you're doing it on a Tuesday. Well, I mean, during the work week, because that's, yeah, but thank you.
We certainly understand that, you know, that presents a challenge for a lot of people, and there is a sacrifice, you know. So we may forsake perhaps a greater participation. You know, if we had this on a Saturday or Sunday, perhaps we might see larger numbers, but we're also realistic about what this particular action, what its goal is. And the notion that on this one day we are going to put some sort of significant dent in the bank accounts of, you know, the capitalist system, those who are sort of hell-bent on acquisition and resource acquisition. The idea that we're going to, you know, significantly damage their bank account, probably not. But what we can do is raise awareness, to help educate, to show people what the alternatives are, and to, you know, make a contribution to sort of expand the dialogue, and, you know, to continue to plant seeds. But also to stress the urgency of this. We don't really have time, as, you know, science tells us. We're really, you know, it's like each day we pass a new tipping point where, you know, we're not going to get this back. So, you know, there definitely is a feeling we got to do this quick. People need to become aware of what the reality is here, as soon as possible.
I agree. It's we have all these other causes, and they're good, and we need to take care of them. But you know what? They're not going to mean a tinker's dam if we have no planet. And
right.
So working against this, fighting the climate change and working for the planet, it needs to take the top priority, in my opinion. But we realize things are so interwoven, interconnected.
Sure.
And then that's where I believe the, because this is called Strike Climate Change, One Day
right.
Boycott of Fossil Fuels and Factory Farming. So factory
right.
farming has, besides striking at our very souls, it has done a lot
sure.
against the planet. So how did you put the two together, Mimi?
Well, I think when you take a look at where the big contributions to climate change go, I think people's first, you know, they're generally going to go to their focus is going to be on fossil fuels, on or on transportation, that sort of thing. But you know, the agribusiness, factory farming, its contribution mm-hmm. to climate change is so insanely significant. That you sort of, if you're going to talk about climate change, you can't ignore this. I mean, there's the fuel that's used in transport of the foods. There's the pesticides. There's the runoff. You know, it's almost this endless cycle of damage that's created through factory farming. And I think this is also an opportunity, again, to show folks, what are the alternatives for you? I mean, look, we understand that not everybody is vegetarian, not everybody is vegan.
Yeah.
So, you know, what can you do to better educate about sort of weaning yourself from factory farming? And, you know, as we discussed, you had brought up before we spoke that, you know, there's sort of no humane way of, I forget how you phrased it, but something like, you know, with regard to the slaughter of animals.
Right.
You know.
No humane way to murder, no matter what anyone says. So.
And I do understand. But the reality is we're not, probably not going to snap our fingers and have everybody become vegan overnight. So.
Right.
And well, you know, so.
Mondays, you know, a lot of people who are carnivores still do observe Meatless Mondays for their own health and for that of the planet and the animals.
Sure.
So there's a lot of different ways to work.
Absolutely. There's CSAs. There's, you know.
Exact farming. Yeah. Education, yeah. Education, education.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, okay. You know, in the statement, we provided links to resources where people could educate themselves to find out what the alternatives are, where they are, to see what the impact is through the continued use of factory farming. And so far, it's been fantastic. Now, the message is that we posted on the event page and on the website, as it's our one of the goals is to expand far outside the circles that are already sort of aware of these issues, and to start
mm-hmm.
to reach new ears. Now, we are aware that in the message, it's pretty harsh in its approach to capitalism, as it should be, I think.
It's against
so,
evil.
You know,
it can be harsh.
Absolutely. You know, so we certainly understand that, you know, people are going to look at this who aren't already sort of on board with this, and it may sting a little bit at first, and some of the language might sound... you know, it may sound unlike anything that they've seen before, but that's okay. You know, it's sort of taking that next step forward. If, and perhaps the next thing that they read, it'll get a little bit easier to sort of to digest. So we're very happy. And what folks have been doing, and I would encourage anybody to do, is when they go to that event page on Facebook, once they join it, they have an opportunity then to invite their friends list. And so we can increase the number of eyes exponentially that review this information and that review these alternatives when people join and then they invite their friends list. And people have been doing that, and that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Sharing the information and sort of gaining this opportunity to have another dialogue. And again, this is just, you know, it's one contribution among many, and we hope it's a valuable contribution, but we're really pleased to be able to offer this.
Well, and you said something that's very important, because it's true, so many people preach to the choir, and,
yes.
You know, that's good. That keeps us all inspired, too, but we need to get out of those safe confines. And so if people want to put this on a couple lists or in a couple groups or pages where it's not necessarily the main topic, go ahead. You know, do it. I mean, the most that people are going to do is either complain, delete it,
sure.
or delete you.
Sure.
But you know what? You got to take a stand. So put it
sure.
out there
yeah.
that this is good.
Absolutely.
And I want to say that this is in 2 weeks, and so people still have time to power up your bikes. Hey, that Tuesday on the 17th, you know, think about biking to work. Part of the way, anyway. You know, just different things. There's all kinds of things you can do, and it makes you more aware. Somebody's going to ask you, why did you decide that you're going to be buying work now? And then you have a perfect opportunity to spread the word. So,
yes. You know, Ruthanne, I think one of the criticisms that we hear frequently about sort of, the left in the U.S. is that the messaging at times can sort of sound really sort of like highbrow and like,
yeah.
highly academic and all that sort of stuff. So we put some effort into how do we, or what can we do to really make the message like powerful and friendly, and to sort of bring people in as opposed to perhaps turning people off with this, I don't know what the right word to use is, but, a vocabulary that and a language that people aren't necessarily used to. We want to make sure that this translates and, it really speaks to people's hearts and that they can understand on an emotional level. Because sometimes, the language on the left, it can almost be dizzying at times,
It can be. And, you have to study it and get to the heart of it. And what you're saying makes so much sense, because you're making it user friendly.
Yeah,
and
just user friendly and like.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things, I think, a lot of the messaging from the left in the U.S. Once you read it, and you understand it, and then it's. A lot of it is it's such a common sense, and, it's so heavily built around care and compassion and love, and you realize that, if this messaging could be presented in a way that everybody easily understood, we would make such progress. So I think, we are placing a lot of emphasis on the messaging. And so when we put together the statement for this particular event, that was something that was very important to us, to create the messaging in a way that people could really connect with.
I think that you succeeded. So I'm very anxious to see how this goes. And this, like so many things, it's like, okay, this is the first time for this particular event. So the first time is one of those you're starting to get committed with. And there will be a lot of lessons learned, because there always is.
Yes.
But I think this is very commendable. It's strikeclimatechange.org. You can find out all about this. And we will also on Air Marte Field put different links. So I've been speaking
with
Soltysik and in California. So we want to have you back, and you can send
thank you.
Everything. So thank you so much for coming in, Mimi.
Thank you, Ruthanne. I appreciate it so much.
again, I apologize to the audio. They heard everything, though, and you can go to Aramarte Field Radio on Facebook, and the site that name are there, so there's no problem finding them. And now we're back with Sarit. And Sarit Jason's world views, actually. She views the world through maybe a little different lens than a lot of people, and that's a good thing. Hello, Sarit.
Hi. How are you doing?
I am great. How about you?
Almost great. Yeah, we have some sad things to talk about again.
Definitely.
Because
we say we're great because, you know, our spirits are up and we're like
we perfect. Are.
We're great. But there's so many things that can get us down. Do you want to start out? Because there's a couple things that I noticed this week. Go ahead. What's weighing really heavy on you tonight, Sarit?
I just noticed Gaza has been under attack. The situation in Israel is getting worse, actually. I don't know where to start, from the fact that they're concentrating on the wrong things while they're just sending people more demolition orders. Today, more demolition orders were given to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
From north to south.
Well, they hired, I know, on the fishermen. In fact, I mean, in the last couple of days, I think a fisherman died. I could be wrong.
Yes, died from his wounds in Gaza. Definitely.
Right. And because, you know, they've extended the fishing limit supposedly to like 6 miles or something, but the Zionists don't get that. So any Gazan fisherman out there in the Med is subject to being fired upon anytime. And it's like they use them for target practice or something. So that was, you know, one of the things this time. But I saw about the water again, Sarit, and in the West Bank, the settlers steal a lot of the water. We know that, like, the Palestinians just have mere liters a day to get by, while the Zionists are stealing the water for their swimming pools and their green parks and everything. And then,
oh yes,
they try to sell the water back, you know, some of it.
Yes, very expensive back.
Well, I saw a picture, and I guess I had just never seen this picture before, of big tanks, because the water is tanked in. We talked before about the water in Gaza. There's not enough, and it's so contaminated. And there's so many children suffering just from chronic diarrhea. And I did not know that diarrhea is the number one killer of children around the world, children under the age of 5.
I didn't know.
It is. That's horrible. But these pictures were, it was a couple tanks, and they had been shot a couple feet off the ground. Just fire it so the water is spilling out, because this is what the Zionists were doing. So even when they managed to get water hauled in and tanks and things, the Zionists, they'll either, you know, upset it or something, like in the West Bank, or shoot the tanks to keep people from having water. I mean, that is just inhumane.
It's as inhumane as it gets. Seems like we have people that lost their humanity running the occupation.
Yeah, I agree.
In fact, the occupation very much corrupts. What very much upset me this week was the fact that they have a dumb reality TV show, and one of the girls on Facebook told me she was upset. She told me that one of the guys was speaking about gang raping young girls in the reality TV show. It was in the context of him acting, of course, not like saying that's what I want to do, but I see the Israeli girls are upset by it, and it upset me to hear it for some reason, too.
Well, yeah.
It's a hard thing to explain.
It really is, and people don't understand. On another show here on the station called The Dialogue, we've been talking about the war on women. And around the world, I just saw that some idiotic Indian man from India, some politician, said that, well, sometimes rape is wrong and sometimes it's not.
Yeah,
it's like, what the hell? Where, you know, so it's not just the Zionist soldiers. And I'm sure, I don't know what the U.S. soldiers are doing right now and all the countries they're invading, but I know in the past.
I had men from Pakistan message me to tell me the women there are raped.
See?
On Facebook.
That's
as a cry, you know, tell somebody, they're raping our women, help us. Pakistan, many women have been raped, brutally raped. I've seen it on pictures. I've seen graphic pictures of soldiers raping women, American. But I know I've spoken to Palestinian women who reported being raped as well by Israeli soldiers.
Yes,
they just don't want to make it public.
Well, and
rape
is a
terrible.
Well, it's a horrible thing.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing under any conditions, but when it's because it's always it's not about sex; it's about power and control. So anytime that somebody has that type of control over you, it's just horrible. But whatever, whether somebody who violates your home or your body, whatever. But your body, you know, this is the one thing that we should be able to say no and have people respect no. I think that's horrid. So
yeah, there's an epidemic of girls reporting rape in Israel, and the police does not believe them, so they started a unit to investigate false accusations. As if every second accusation is a false one. They don't understand. Statistically speaking, maybe 1 out of 100 is a false one, and not even.
Ah. Okay, I didn't know. They actually, with all the things wrong, they get a unit to investigate false rape reports.
Yeah.
That made me
so angry.
That is too absurd.
I told you how it's an epidemic there, and it's harder to walk the street there as a girl than here.
Yeah.
You'll get catcalled.
These are the things that we definitely, in the U.S., if we listen to mainstream media, we will never hear these things. That's just...
Never.
Currently, because they're not going to talk about it. And... because, you know, there's so much support for Israel from the right-wingers. But that was something good I read, that there are actually some Christian groups, and I use the word, loosely, they self-identify Christian groups, that are actually trying to put some pressure on those totally idiotic, ignorant, fanatical right-wing Christers who are so pro-Israel. They're trying to put some pressure on them and say, hey, you know, lay off, like peace could be a good thing kind of thing. So, I mean, that gave me a little, you know, boost of optimism there too.
There's definitely an organization called Rabbis for Human Rights who are doing incredible work.
Yes, that's what we have to remember. You know, because you are Jewish, but a lot of American people need to, and not just Americans, because I've heard people from around the world make all these comments about Jewish people. And it has nothing, I mean, it's not a Jewish thing, it's a Zionist entity thing. And so many
Absolutely.
People are fighting.
You know,
so
what's ironic? Some of the most furious activists for Palestine I ever met are from Israel.
Exactly. Right. Right.
It's a civil war, so we're not all against them.
No. No, absolutely not. And that's what I try to tell
people.
It is
a civil war, if you think about it. We're all...
It is. Well, like you're talking
brothers.
About Semites. Well, Semites fighting Semites. I mean, if, you know, but it's... It's a war because we're all one family, the human family. So whatever is going on, you know, halfway around the world to somebody there, it's to me too, because I'm connected. Like, I'm connected to those women that are being raped. And, you know, when you start looking at it like that, you get a totally different perspective.
Oh, yeah. They are
I think,
us, we are them.
Yeah, so that,
no
that's
doubt.
What we have to keep reminding people. We're so interconnected. You can't you can't just say that that's their problem, because it's our problem. I hear one of your babies.
You heard them. They got excited over something. Yeah, they're very excitable. I knew you're going to hear them sometime.
Oh, it's fun, though. Oh, sometimes you'll hear my neighbor's dog, because it sounds like he's right in the room with me. I mean, I don't know. That dog is, it's noisy, but I can't really think about it. So, yeah. My sort of resting right now. One's resting here on his bench, but the other two are in the other room, so it's all good.
Israel has a new president. Apparently, he's also accused of rape. In the past,
Tell us about him. I mean, he's, because I don't know that much about his background. I heard that Netanyahu wasn't particularly thrilled, like we care.
He's a right winger.
Yeah, well, now he really
he's for
has,
settlement.
Well, right there it tells you he's a jerk. He doesn't have much power, am I right? Or what is his power?
I have no idea, actually, what it
okay.
is, a president's power in Israel. It's not much, kind of like a president here.
Okay, well, but here, the president is supposedly the head of things. There it seems like the prime minister, Netanyahu, is.
Yeah, the prime minister.
So that the president
it's more
is
more official.
Yeah, it's official and sort of for parties and looks and things. I don't know.
The hunger strike is going on. And while the Palestinians are on hunger strike, they're getting the people to talk about the president, so no one notices there's a hunger strike. No one notices that even Israeli doctors refuse to force feed them, like they try to pass a law to force feed the Palestinian prisoners. It passed, and Israeli doctors got very angry, wrote letters saying they won't do it. But, you know, they always find someone to do it. So,
Right. They will find somebody who isn't
sad.
Necessarily even a doctor, but some type of a hospital worker or whatever. And the problem with that is then those are going to be the people that are, rougher, not as trained or not as gentle as a doctor could be.
Okay.
I mean, you know, because now these doctors that refuse, they're actually good people, because they, to that extent that they just can't bring themselves to force that. But if they were to, at least they would be gentler with them, at least in my opinion, than somebody then that after you've tried everybody that actually has, you know, that should be the ones that have the power and they refuse to do it, then you start going like for cruel prison guard kinds of things. You know what I'm saying? I could be wrong, but
absolutely.
That's the way it feels. Like they're going to get those people that are just sadistic, more sadistic, and so they'll make it even rougher. Just like here in Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, the way the hunger strikers were just, you know, forced. And they would just, like, drag them to wherever and, you know, tie them down and force this down them. So force feeding, it is so, so wrong. I don't know. But, I mean, I just the doctors that refused, all I can say is good for them. But I
agree.
I mean, they because that took courage because they could actually lose their jobs and stuff for not following orders or even be imprisoned themselves. So, you know, they're standing for what they believe. I just fear that it may make it rougher on the prisoners, the strikers. I don't know. I just think it's a horrible thing for people to...
I am so speechless about the force feeding. Force feeding itself is torture, illegal by international law. So that's the simple two facts. And the rest, what you said, I 100% couldn't agree with more. I'm speechless. I'm so sad because I know what these prisoners are going through. I have read reports of their conditions. If I was in those conditions, I would ask someone to just put me out. They are, by the way, in cells under the ground, no light coming, no light in the day or night. The cells are wet and cold like graves. And there's rats. There's no clean water, no running water. No place to move. They have to sleep touching each other. That's not nice.
I would not
even punish a pedophile that way. That's just insane. And I hate pedophiles
because once we do that to someone, you know, we lost our humanity. And
totally.
So whatever a person has done. Because I know people, sometimes, you know, we'll put some article on Facebook or talk to someone about some horrific thing, and people say, oh, they should be this and this and this, and they should be this and this and this. And I don't agree, because that means if we step to a certain level, we've lost our humanity. And remember Vic, who was killed in Gaza, who, you know, his tagline was stay human?
Yes.
I think that's a good one for all of us. And as much as we hate what these people are doing, there again, we have to remember, just like with all these victims around the world that we're connected to them, we're connected to these evildoers also.
Yes.
Because we're humans. We are still in the same family. And we don't want to lose our humanity just because they have. And that's a real rough, that's a rough one, really.
That's a good one, absolutely.
But it's hard because we think, wow, fine, they should just do this to them. But those are unspeakable things, what you're talking about, and they need to be spoken about as far as, you know, being in like an underground hole with no water and just dampness and rats and all these bodies. No light.
No light.
No one should ever be put in that position.
And who knows what we don't know. I mean, that's just a few blogs that I read.
Yeah.
By the way, I was watching the Israeli TV talk about this whole issue, and it's amazing how washed up their language was and how there was... They implied that they're getting the best conditions, and they made it sound like the Palestinian prisoners are in some kind of fancy hotel almost.
Oh, please.
Oh,
right.
I was.
Right.
It's so upsetting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Propaganda.
You know, I wonder, aside from a PR move on their part, I wonder if there's a big budget, if the prisons and things have a big budget and they don't spend it where they're supposed to, so because other people are skimming off the top, but yet they want the populace to think that these people are having, you know, wonderful prison with conditions.
Yeah.
While they're living off the money that should be. And we need to say, a lot of these men have never been charged with anything.
Very true. Not only that, reports from soldiers who are breaking the silence will prove so. They say that sometimes they write they did something just to fuck with people.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're on patrol and you're just having a boring day, hey, there's a Palestinian. Hey,
never underestimate the power of hate. Yes.
Yeah.
The power
exactly.
of hate. And alienation and racism, whatever. Another thing is shaking Israel right now is a famous new scandal.
What's it?
A young lady has been accused of pedophilia. So I go look at it, at the case. A young lady apparently slept with lots of guys here. And then I read again from different sources, like Haaretz, a really nice newspaper, and apparently sounds like they were abusing her, threatening her. And nowadays there's a lot of people threatening with saying they will rape and put it online. She slept with some really young boys because apparently they were threatening her, she says. For some reason I believe her, I don't know why. There's also reports that she was begging help from the police and they were not helping her. This is, for example, a 13-year-old boy said, shut up, son of a bitch, and it made him laugh, and they were all, like, gang-raping her. And now she's in jail, like, she's accused of pedophilia now because she was acting like a victim and froze instead of screaming and scratching. But they did beat her up, too, so there was a few times, I guess. Sometimes she was wounded, and they still don't see that she might be the victim here. I'm confused.
No.
Maybe
I mean,
I'm missing something.
They don't want to see. Was she a teacher or something, Sarit? Or?
No.
Huh?
No, there was many times she was asking them to stop or not to do it, but I guess that's not considered enough in Israel. I don't know. What is she supposed to do, beat them back up?
I guess, and then for sure lose their life or be beat even more. That whole thing about fighting back, I really resent that because many times women are just completely overpowered. And fighting back's going to get them killed, whereas they think, well, maybe if they just don't fight back, they'll be raped, but they'll be left with their life.
Oh, yeah, the kind of guys that bully women are very scary and big.
Yeah, yeah.
They are, and they're very strong. They don't realize they're very strong.
Well, and there again, you know what? It is also, even one who isn't strong enough, say some guy, I mean, he's not going to go out there and, like, lift, you know, 200-pound things, you know, 10 times. However, With that rush, that adrenaline rush of doing something he's not supposed to be doing, and then particularly if there's other guys around, you know, that gives him an extra rush. So it's sort of like those people who've been able to, like, lift a car off their kid or something. You know what I mean? They get this rush, and they do things that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to do. So physically, I mean, even somebody who might not be able to do certain things at a moment like that can. So these men, I mean, they've got this mental thing going, and the adrenaline's pumping, and they can really overpower the person. So, no, there is no excuse for rape. None. And I don't,
well,
I mean,
it breaks my heart. She's in jail.
You know, that is so wrong.
Isn't it? It's like second rape. And this is the boy's testimony that they called her a whore. So I'm confused. They beat her. They confessed of beating her.
And
you know what they say? That because she was older, and they were the 14-year-olds, then she could have saved herself from them or something.
That's ridiculous.
Isn't it? Suddenly the age is what's important.
Well, I've seen 14-year-old boys. I mean, there's no way that I'd try to fight them.
No, me neither. Scary.
I'd
send my dog.
So, there you go.
Dogs are, yeah. So this is a terrible case that makes me realize something is far gone in that country. They're always blaming the victim, time after time.
Yeah.
Calling the victim a slut, always. Calling the victim insane. They have these, for such a small country to have so many cases. I watched the local news here in Tennessee. We had one rape murder here in the last week that was on the TV.
Oh.
A man ate the victim in Coffee County, Tennessee.
Okay, I saw. He cut hands and feet off, I think, and maybe the head. And then he ate of, I just came on air. Yeah.
We need free mental health clinics everywhere, please. Really,
right.
It's so scary. People really need mental health everywhere. Make it free for the masses, that anyone can just go in with not even show ID and get help. Because I think this country's having a serious problem with mental health. People shooting is a mental health problem.
Yeah, there's so much anger in this country.
Yeah. If they didn't have the guns, they'd probably beat each other up. I remember in London there was a lot of stabbings.
Yeah.
When I was living there. They really need mental health clinics everywhere.
Yeah.
One day.
People are angry. And, you know, some people really don't understand why. I mean, they don't understand that, you know, they're, like, here living in a capitalist system where the working people are just numbers to those who have the money. And
we're all suffering. We don't know how much. We've never seen it any other way.
Some of us understand where it's coming from, but others just don't. So they're really angry. And then that makes them go just
you're right.
And then, you know, instead of doing something productive, you know, the situation, they find somebody who is more helpless, like this woman. He said he'd never met her before that day.
Oh, wow.
I read that, but I don't even know how he met her or what. But as I understood, I mean, this was not somebody that he knew. And, you know, how horrible. But I agree with you. We need a lot of mental health care. And we need that, particularly like when people are coming back, service people, military people.
Yeah.
It seems that, you know, they need a lot of help. They're suffering from that PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder, and
after what I've seen, I would cancel all the armies in the world. I've seen what.
I was
in an IDF base after the soldiers came from Gaza, and they were screaming and crying, and I didn't see one happy soldier like you see in the pictures and the videos that you see nowadays. Back then, everyone was so. I've never seen anyone so sad in my life. They could never stop crying. I'm not kidding. I thought I crossed into the Twilight Zone. You know, in the Twilight Zone, I was in the. Every man in my base was crying like a 3-year-old. I don't know what they did, but I know it must have been horrible.
Yeah. That's
yeah, and that they'll never recover. Something terrible is happening in the military. No one should do that. No. We need to and the fascism, that fascist element in our
all
society.
Around the world. And
we're trying.
It's catching, though. I mean, a lot of countries seem to be leaning in that direction. So I don't know. I don't know.
It's really hurting the boys, you know.
Yeah. And
I have seen every boy I know, from the boys that grew up, be terribly wounded from being the oppressor in the army.
Yeah.
It totally destroys their soul. They totally lose their humanity.
It really does.
Some of them.
Well, it has to be something that, you know, they're going to spend the rest of their life regretting. I mean, and some of them will, and, you know, go on, like the people in Breaking the Silence. I mean, they're really working on themselves because they can live with the guilt, and so they're talking about it and helping each other and trying to let all of us know what's going on. I think what is it, the Veterans for Peace in this country, the U.S., they I don't know if they talk quite as much about it, maybe when there's just a couple of them together, they're actually working for peace. So, you know, because they did not like what they did and what they saw. And they realized it was for a bunch of lies. Nobody was attacking them. You know, they were going places to protect corporations that were in these countries to steal resources. That's what it's about. So, well, our time is up, and I guess I will see you next Wednesday. So don't forget,
great,
full moon this Friday the 13th.
And, oh, how lovely.
Yes, because we won't have another full moon on Friday the 13th until 2049. So, celebrate this one.
Lovely.
Thanks so much, Sarit. Thank you.
Pleasure.
See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Our guest for okay. It looks like we may have him here.
Hello.
So now we do have, he made it in. So we've got Tommy Liberato. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, welcome back. And I want to say congratulations. You recently got married, yeah.
Yes, I did. It's definitely very exciting to be entering a new stage of life, huh?
Here you go. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I mean, it's a new adventure. It's a new book. So, yeah. And you know, it's always learning. It's always, we learn as we go. So this is great. But I'm really happy to have you back. And therefore, I thought, is he going to call in or not? But
Definitely. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I know sometimes, you know, it's like, oh, you look at the clock, it's like, oh, God. Yeah. So tonight we're going to talk about Marxism some, about social movements and community organizing. And, you know, Marxism has been really downed by so many people who don't understand it. So, and then even by, you know, when you get into the movement, you've got the Marxists and the Leninists and the Trotskyists and, you know, just on. And there's so much disagreement there even. But explain, what is Marxism, Tommy?
Sure. So Marxism, right, is this really ambiguous term. And you've already mentioned some of the issues. You have people who are Marxists, but they're Marxist-Leninists, and people who are Marxists, but they're Trotskyists, and this and that and the third, right? Basically, in short, what Marxism is one, it is a philosophical worldview. So it contains a philosophical worldview, which basically says, look, the world that we see is actually in motion. Nothing is really static. It's not really standing still. And if you look closely and you examine things closely, you'll see that everything is mutable. Everything can be changed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's actually something that's really fundamental to Marxism, and sometimes even among people who identify as Marxists, that gets forgotten. Now, the other part, of course, is that there's this idea of materialism. And what that really means is it's not so much like, oh, I'm materialistic, I want a lot of stuff. What it means is that the world that we live in contains all of the things that we need in order to make it into something else. What does that mean? Did you have a question about that?
No, that you mean like we've got all the building blocks that we need for whatever we're going to do or want to do.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And what that means in terms of sort of an everyday person is that, number one, if you want to understand how a person makes sense of themselves, and the world that they're in, as well as other people, then you actually have to understand what their daily life is. And for Marx refers to that as human activity. What is our activity? What are the things that we do in relation to what other people are doing and in relation to our basic needs on a daily basis? If you understand that, then you start to understand how it is that we develop the ways that we think. And, of course, if you understand how we develop the ways that we think, we can also understand how we can influence each other and begin a dialogue with each other so that we can begin to think differently.
Okay.
And you can see where that goes in terms of social movement.
Right. Yes. Well, and this is something that has been said, at least in certain, well, different ways, but maybe the meaning, you know, the thing about walking in my shoes, you know, walking in somebody else's shoes to understand them kind of thing. So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, you're saying you understand the human activity, which means other humans and ourselves, in relation to ourselves on a daily basis, not just highlights here and there, but the whole juicy compost altogether.
Yeah.
To really know where this is coming from. Yeah, like that.
Those are two really important points. And then there's this idea of contradictions that, and this relates to the idea that the world is always in motion. And the basic idea, and I mean, Marx didn't invent this, right? This is something that's been around in ancient Greek philosophy as well as far back into different ancient African philosophies as well. But the idea is that there are these opposing forces that exist in the world that allow the world to move in any particular direction to transform itself, right? The best example, or the most simple example I can give, is if you are going to jump, right? If there's no gravity, then there's no, it doesn't make sense, the idea of jumping, right?
Right.
So the whole notion, the very idea that of the word jump doesn't, no longer makes any sense, because there's no gravity, so there is no jumping, there is no nothing. You're just there. But with it, now if you put that in terms of contradictions, then what you have is, well, the human body is designed in such a way that it has these muscles that kind of create a counter force to the existing, you know, natural gravity. And that allows us to propel our bodies forward or upwards for a period of time and in those different ways. So that would be sort of the idea of the opposing forces. In terms of society, right? In terms of society, what that means is that the world is always, that society is always being pulled in different directions by different social movements, by different, like, vast, you know, numbers of people in different groups, different organizations who are working for competing visions. And whichever, you know, sort of broad groups of people are dominating, that's the direction that the world goes in. That makes sense.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not necessarily a democracy, but it's a matter of numbers or strength or whatever. So, sure. And the contradictions, I guess, you know, if everything was always on a plateau, it would be not only very boring. We need those valleys and mountaintops, and that helps us grow as an individual and as a people, as a species. So it's good to have some contradictions.
Sure. The thing is, contradictions in themselves are not necessarily bad. Like you said,
right,
they're necessary. The issue arises when you start examining what does it mean for a certain type of contradiction to exist, and how did that contradiction come about? So when we talk about capitalism, you're talking about different types of contradictions. You're talking about the contradictions that, one, separate human beings, like our needs, our most fundamental needs, from those means which would allow us to fulfill those needs, and that means that it stops our development. It prohibits us from becoming more than what we are today, tomorrow.
Right, okay. Exactly. So you're saying you have to go to the source and see exactly where it came from.
Definitely. You see where it comes from, and then you see what it does. And
right,
then you say, okay, this particular type of contradiction, or what flows from this contradiction, is not good, so we need to do something to change it, to bring about justice, right?
Right.
And the last thing I will say, and then please just, you know, just kind of any questions you have about stuff, just put it out there. I'd like to, like for it to be more than me just kind of rambling.
No. You're saying a lot of good things.
The last thing I would say, what makes Marxism significant in terms of socialism is that, historically speaking, before Marx, there wasn't a theory of socialism as a movement. Before socialism was understood, in theory, of course, socialism was understood as basically there would be like some type of government or some type of body that of citizens who would distribute the resources and regulate those resources so that everyone had what they needed to live, right? But what Marx found problematic about that is that it could also turn into a very repressive and oppressive society, because you still had a system in which the people were alienated from the direct governance of those resources. So you would have a small group of people, or even a larger group of people, but nevertheless, it would be a relatively small group of people who would decide, okay, people need this, this, and that, and the third. And it was very top-down. So for Marx, Marx was one of the first to really say, look, socialism is something that comes from the oppressed, from the masses, and therefore comes from below, and it comes out of, and what it will look like will be determined by their actual lived experiences, as opposed to some type of, you know, I would say ideological vision, some type of projection that comes from a group of people. Does that make any sense?
No, totally. Because somebody, I was just having that kind of conversation with somebody recently, is that they were saying, well, that this can't work, you're still going to have, you know, like the governing body. And I said, yes, but the governing body is not going to just like be laying down these laws, because it's going to be coming from the people who are involved, as opposed to what we have in the U.S. right now. Because we have people who we loosely call representatives who are not representing us at all.
Right. Absolutely. And related to that, you know, one of the things that I think for me that's a very powerful vision that comes from Marx, and this is why I sometimes go back and forth and I'm just like, yeah, I'm just a socialist, you know, or a democratic socialist, because I do believe, I think democracy is a fundamental principle, right? It's at the same time, I don't want to lose the concept of Marxism, because what Marx says, and what people who follow Marx, who have followed Marx directly, what they say is that socialism isn't so much just a system as it is a movement, something that's always in the making, always in, you know, in process. So right now, if Marx were around, I would guess that he would say that socialism is a combination of all these different movements right now that we're seeing that seek to transform the existing power relations. Now, what I mean by that is this. It's one thing to talk about redistribution of economic resources.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, and actually, in a Marxian perspective, you could do this and not actually be having socialism or engaged in socialism. In fact, you could have something where every single person had everything that they needed, and Marx might even say, that's nice, but this is not socialism. This is not what I had in mind, because there's still a power structure in which there's a group of people who are governing the actions and the activity of other people.
Right.
And so the other issue becomes, beyond redistribution or distribution of resources, comes the issue of who produces what and how production is determined. Right? How is the work being determined? How is the work form being determined? And towards what end? Then when that is determined democratically and in a way that those who are directly working with that, if it's determined in that way, then Marx would say, okay, we have now a social society.
Okay. So,
what do you think about that?
I want to know how we're going to get to that, if that's really possible, because like you said, myself and a lot of people would like to to see a guaranteed income for people, just so that somebody is going to do without clothes, food, and a place to live. But in our vision, then that wouldn't stop them from having their own businesses or going in together with a co-op kind of thing, with, you know, worker-owned businesses and things. But it would be like a base. And so if they didn't want to work or do anything else, that would be fine, too. I mean, they have to. But a lot of people do like to do things with their lives. So, but I don't see how, without some kind of rules, regulations, as much as we don't like the way that sounds, without that, I don't know how
repeat that one more time? You were breaking up a little bit, or maybe it was my phone, I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. I was talking about rules and regulations, how we don't really like a lot of them, you know, laws, the way they're made and enforced, but I don't know how we would be able to get to this point without having some kind of a structure.
Sure.
And even if it's just a structure to keep our infrastructure running, which doesn't do all that well sometimes, but you know, like we need new roads, we need new bridges, so somebody needs to say, well, you know, blah blah blah. I don't know how, without having people in charge, it can work.
Yeah, sure. That's a really good question, right? And so this is where it gets tricky for Marxism. The big issue is there's a second concept, right? The concept of communism. And unfortunately, because of all the horrible stuff with the Soviet Union and, you know, Stalinism and just you name it, right, that the very word communism is lost, right, in terms of being a meaningful concept. But Marx actually has two concepts, right? He talks about communism as being sort of the long, long, long-term vision in which all of human society would be basically brought together in solidarity. And for Marx, communism is where we move towards this kind of classless and stateless society, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for socialism, now kind of represents both of those concepts in some ways, because it's still the most usable concept. It's a little bit less offensive than using the word communism. Socialism for Marx would have been, as he called it, the lower stage. This would be the period where the famous quote, the dictatorship of the proletariat, which actually refers to the idea that the governmental structures would like the government itself and all kind of political institutions would be under the control of working class organizations. In that period of time, that's where you would be talking about, well, how do we, you know, maintain these types of regulations and make sure things are, the work is being done and coordinating things. And during that whole period of time, which there is no set period, right? We don't know how many years that would be. That would be the time in which you'd start seeing the development of new forms of governance, right? Like community councils maybe, or some type of public assemblies and things like that around. I think Venezuela in some ways comes close to it. I don't want to say that is exactly what I think Marx would have had in mind, or what a lot of folks would have in mind. But in Venezuela, they had, and I think they still do, they had these sort of community organizations that would, in a way, serve as like local community spaces where the community could really come in and make policy based on, you know, their immediate needs and some of their longer term needs at the local level, and then they would send that information back to the larger government in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
That system is by, you know, in no way perfect, but you could imagine that with a strong socialist movement, you could start seeing those types of governmental or structures of governance emerging, and also increase a workplace democracy. And over time, this kind of detached governmental structure that we have right now would sort of wither away, right? That's where the withering away of the state comes from, right?
Right, because, well, you know, now so many people are working two or three jobs just to make ends meet, because we're in such a consumerism type society. But people have put it out with automation being what it is. So there's no reason why things can't progress to the point where people might work 2 hours a day at a job they really like or not, because there'll be some jobs that are sort of, but you can take this with those. But the rest of the time is free time to be creative, to spend with your friends, to spend with your family. where people can actually be human, not just drones. So I think it's something for people to really look forward to. Backtracking, I want to state for our listeners who don't maybe understand, what was called communism in the Soviet Union, Stalinism was not communism. And so many people, you know, they say, well, look how it worked in Russia. Look how it worked, you know. That wasn't it. I just wanted to throw that out because that's what we were taught. That's what we're taught in this country. That, you know, communist Russia, you know, better dead than red and all this stuff. And, you know, it's there's a lot of that hangover from those days that people still holding on to.
Yeah, definitely. And again, that kind of gets back to the idea of when Marx talks about materialism or the material world and how from our daily lives and our experiences, our consciousness is developed. So for people who grew up in the United States during the time of, you know, Stalinism and the Soviet Union, their part of their consciousness is, in fact, one, what actually happened over there and the stories they've heard, and also those media representations of communism and socialism and different types of political struggle, as presented by, of course, the mass media, who also has an interest in maintaining a status quo. So that becomes part of their consciousness, and all kinds of very deep rooted things, such as what does it mean to be American, gets wrapped into, you know, this kind of anti-communism. And then you start digging even deeper, and you find out that part of being an American, that's tied to, well, I'm a provider for my family, I work hard, I do these kinds of things, and the whole, you know, you just start to see the whole gamut of things, and it all comes all the way down to the most basic things in our daily lives, and that's how ideology works.
Mm-hmm. And we are told, just like we know mainstream media pretty much sucks as far as truth, you know, things are in the subconscious, they're just put there subliminally. So much, I don't have TVs, and I rarely go to theaters or watch even newer movies online, but I watch old movies because I'm a big fan of film noir, and then got into watching like First World War, Second World War movies because I watch movies from that time period, and it is so amazing. Once you see the kind of propaganda that was put out about like Germany and Russia in the Second World War, well, the Germany during the Second World War and then Russia afterwards, in the movies, American made movies and British made movies, oh my goodness, you know, when you once break through that whatever, that wall, and you see. So, of course, people who watch those movies are going to have a totally slanted, different version of reality going on in their heads. And so I'm just saying that the motion picture industry is very powerful, always has been. And just like the TV shows now, because I hear about, you know, different shows, and people really are addicted to them. And they take them for truth in many instances.
Sure.
So
sorry.
That's, you know, we need, it seems that on the left, at least with the people I know, we just don't have that kind of money, you know. We need to be able to put some movies out there that are, you know, like realistic and that kind of thing. Because we years ago on TV, you know, I don't know if it was like the first, maybe the Jeffersons or something, started bringing, or maybe Archie, Funker and the Jefferson started bringing, instead of black people being, not demonized, but ridiculed or, you know, having kind of point, it was more fun, like middle America, whatever that is. But I mean, you know, not really poor people, really wealthy people, working people, but they had things going on for them. Like maybe Will and Grace was one of the first shows with the whole gay plot and everything. We've had different things on TV that brought people into and there's another one. What was his name is George something, who's Hispanic, and he had a show. A comedy, I mean, when I'm talking comedy shows, all of these, but, you know, there's a lot of truth in comedy. That's the best way to get people to start seeing things, by using comedy. So we've had some good come out of the TV industry. I'm not saying it's all bad, but it's very powerful.
You know, and I want to just relate it to that. I want to add that one of the things that turns a lot of people off of Marxism is, in fact, there is this sort of, I don't know what to call it, an academic or intellectual kind of perspective on it or aspect to it, where a big part is studying industries and understanding how those industries work. And then in order to devise some type of strategy or a counter-hegemonic strategy so that people can, one, look at those different types of programs and understand what the messages are in those programs.
Right.
And then, two, it's also to understand how industries, especially, you know, entertainment industries, how they really do shape our consciousness, every single one of us, from left to right. And what you said is really important about the entertainment industry, because think about this. The media, the television, and now the internet, right? The television and the internet are the central ways through which we consume information about the world.
Exactly.
And right. If you've grown up in a certain time period, the TV remains the primary source of information consumption.
Mm-hmm.
What that means then is your picture of the world is what is being put on that television, right? And
exactly.
So that's all you have. So if you live in inner city Philadelphia, which is where I live, if you live in inner city Philadelphia, and you've never traveled across the large state of Pennsylvania into some of the smaller towns, you only have those images and those stories put up on television to kind of guide you as to what kind of people live in small-town rural Pennsylvania. So for me, growing up, it would be those folks over there, they hate me because of my skin color. They'll never speak to me, and they will always vote to make sure, the government passes policies that will further oppress people of color and working class communities here, even though they're working class themselves, right?
Right.
And if you live in rural Pennsylvania, you're thinking I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was telling me that she had never been to Philadelphia or any major city, and the only thing she ever had to watch to teach her about Philadelphia was a show called, or any major city, was a show called Cops, right? So. So she talked about how people in her household and in her community, they would get together, and as part of a social event, they'd watch Cops. Now, for me, at first, I was a little bit mortified by it at first. I was like, oh, my God, that's terrible. And then I thought about it. I said, okay, but understand, we're talking about someone who lives in rural working class neighborhoods. And you have limited types of entertainment, the same way as a lot of folks here in inner city Philadelphia. And the programming that they put on TV there is cops. So your only encounter with people of color comes from a TV show called Cops, where they're being arrested for doing all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah.
Well, what does that do for the race line or for the color line, right? It reinforces, right, racial, you know, racial division, which already exists because of distance, like physical distance, of course, because we don't see each other. You're all the way over there. Yeah. I'm all the way over here. I have no real experience with you.
Well, that's, you know, currently I live in a small town outside of Chicago, and I miss Chicago sometimes, but the people here in Illinois, so, well, a lot of them have never been out of the state, but a lot of them have not been to Chicago because they're terrified.
Right.
And you know, it doesn't, I've just stopped hitting my head against the wall, I'm done. You know, because it doesn't matter how much I talk to them about the wonderful plays, the cultural things, the ethnic markets where I love to go, all of these things, and it doesn't matter because they've got it in their head that, you know, they're going to get shot if they go there. It's so I know what you're saying. It's just you don't know what to do to open up people's minds. So right, we only, you know, somebody said long ago, and I won't even try to quote, but had to do with open your mind. I mean, opening the mind and learning that travel is like the best educator. And I really think that's true. And yeah, some of us can't afford to go maybe around the world, but you know, if you just put yourself in another area of your own country, another situation or something, you will be amazed. I mean, if you go in with an open mind and, you know, an open mind and a smile can work wonders, actually. But, I mean, of course, you have to use some sense to know where you're going. But if you don't go in just knowing everybody's going to hate me because I'm, you know, I'm a woman or because I'm a pagan or because I'm a communist or whatever, you know, because I haven't seen that happened that much if I didn't put it out like that. So I think it's, you know, it's on us too, how we're perceived in a way. But what you're saying is so true, because if people, all they see is the show Cops or something like that, they get a totally unbalanced, we were talking about balance before, they get a totally unbalanced idea of the truth. And so then it's like, okay, well, you know, we just keep trying. But that it was interesting to me to hear you say that, because I talked to people around where I am, and you know, even though it's just a couple hours to Chicago, these people, they've never been there, so many of them, and it's like, well, how can you miss such a horrible place? It's like, well, it was never horrible for me, you know, I love the city. Perspective is so much, yeah. But you're talking about, I mean, and that's part of the whole, like, it goes along with Marxism as far as it's an evolving philosophy, though, because it's not just dogmatic. Like some religions are just dogmatic, and others are flowing and evolving. And, you know, I mean, the world is turning, the world is moving. So how can we not be evolving? It takes a lot of stubbornness and energy to not, in my opinion.
Sure. I mean, it does. And I want to, like, connect this a little bit to the social movement aspect, because Marxism is fundamentally about how to make a social movement or make movements based on an understanding of how the system works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing I would do is try to use that idea that the world is always in motion and translate capitalism into a movement as opposed to just a system.
Okay, so, okay.
So if we can think about capitalism as being a broad movement, right, with different wings, right, you have people who are, you know, liberal. They care about, they recognize the existence of inequality, and they want to make sure that inequality is not too bad and that people are getting some things. And then you have on the other side, you have your kind of neoliberal, which is the dominant, sort of the dominant, I guess, wing of the capitalist movement, and they're just kind of like, forget all that social welfare stuff that's not important at all, right?
Right.
Those are sort of the far, the gamut, right? Now, as a movement, because it is a dominant movement, it has control over all of the main, of the social institutions in our society, you know, from government to education institutions, to the media, et cetera. What that means then is it's going, as a movement, these folks who head up the capitalist movement are going to use those institutions as sort of as weapons, as a means of furthering their cause, right, which is their own enrichment.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, they have to also incapacitate other movements, such as the labor movement, socialist movements, and other types of movements of the oppressed coming from below. One way they do that, because they have control of the government, is through policy, such as, well, transportation policy would be a good one. If you can keep people, you know, physically divided for a long, you know, across the state, then now people only need to rely on what you tell them, right? And this goes back to what we're talking about. What shows you put on television,
right,
that becomes people's world. But the only reason that becomes a person's world is because they can't actually access the other, as you know, the other other places in a state, right?
Right.
Okay. So you can also see how that works with policies such as wages. If I keep your wages low enough, not only am I making it very difficult for you to provide for yourself and for your family, and it also means that you can't go and do these other things, such as maybe go talk to other people. You can't afford to waste time, you know, to deal with these luxuries of interacting with other people. And it also means you can't travel, for a lot of people anyway.
Exactly.
So you're not going to travel. You don't have the time to.
Right, because you're working three jobs to whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You're working all these jobs, right? The other part of that is with rising prices of things, right? Rent. I'll give you an example. Right now, we're paying $995 in rent. It's a nice apartment, sure, but in reality, there's no reason for the rent to be this high in the place that we're living in right now.
Right.
But what that means for us is that a huge portion of our household income is now being eaten up by our rent. That means I need to make sure I work longer hours. Right? And if I work longer hours, then I'll have the income to pay my bills, but I don't necessarily have the income to eat the types of foods I should be eating. I don't have the income to go out and explore different neighborhoods in the city. I don't have the income to do these things, because income is also equal to time.
Right, and you don't have the time because you're working the extra hours to get the. Yeah, it's a terribly vicious circle.
Exactly. So it's a system that's got us, like, that has so many of us. Despite all the resources we have at our disposal, we can't touch those resources, because the most important resource of all is, in fact, the amount of disposable time we have. And that is, we don't have much of it.
Yeah.
So that gets back at the question you had earlier about, well, how do you, what about regulations or what about policy? One of the things that we on the left should really be fighting for is are policies that will free up the amount of time that we have. For example, the $15 minimum wage, the main focus for a lot of people has been that this is going to lift people out of poverty. And that is true. It's going to lift up so many people out of poverty. But the other aspect is that someone who works, you know, is making $15 an hour now no longer has to work 40 hours if they don't have a whole lot of expenses. They can actually work 20 hours now.
Yes. This is
so now all of a sudden they have 20 hours or even more of time that they wouldn't have had before.
It can totally improve quality of life. And I'm a big, like, anti-consumer, and I talk to people about that all the time as far as, you know, making your time count and your experiences. Like, if you're going to spend money, spend it on experiences, not more junk to clutter up your home kind of thing. You know, minimalism is not a bad thing because it frees you to do the things that matter. But we've been taught by these media, whether it's placement in movies and TV shows, and haven't you noticed that placement of that can of soda over there or something? You know, I mean, all of this stuff just keeps coming at people, and they haven't been taught to be discerning. So they think that, well, I need to get that because that'll make me like the person in the movie or whatever, the TV show. So, you know, consumerism is not necessarily a good thing. And people, I think, are, I use the term spiritually bankrupt, but you could use, I don't know, bankrupt of soul or whatever, to the extent that they think that things will make them happy. And what you're talking about, if you don't have a lot of expense, you're getting $15 an hour, working 20 hours a week, you've got all that extra time for something that really matters to you. I mean, I think that's a wonderful concept. So you're just saying that the minimum wage, it's a good thing. I mean, raising it, it's a good thing on different levels for different people.
Yeah, it's good. You know, especially for hourly workers. I think the biggest advantage would be for them, right? And the second thing, another policy that would really help is that of a true universal healthcare as a human right. With that, you also detach people's need for health services from the labor market. And with that, so there's a lot of folks who are out here who are working very particular jobs in order to make sure they have health coverage.
Isn't that sad? I mean, when I first actually heard that, I was appalled that people are working jobs they absolutely hate in some cases, but it's because they can get health care. This should not happen. This should not be going on at all. I agree with you.
Absolutely. So imagine that, though, a $15 minimum wage and universal health care, what that does on one level. One level, you've got health care service, so healthier people, right? Two, better wage, so you're able to buy better food, maybe spend, like you said, spend more money on experiences. Three, you have more time. And the fourth part is this, is that as people feel less coerced to accept conditions that I would say are unacceptable, they will actually stand up. They're more likely to stand up and to say, look, I'm not going to take it. I'm going to organize a union in my workplace because we need workplace democracy. I will not be brutalized. I will not be mistreated here in this workplace. But a lot of folks right now are kind of like, well, I need this job, not just for wages, but I need this job because this is where I get the medical care for my children and for myself.
That's so sad, yeah.
So that's another angle which helps to liberate. It helps to liberate the working class, so that it can continue to develop as a political force.
Yeah. I mean, and what you're talking about is very doable, actually. I mean, it is.
Yeah, it can be done. It really can.
This is a pie in the sky. It's real. It can happen. I don't know, what particular organizations are you yourself involved in?
Sure. One, I am involved in, there's an organization in Pennsylvania called Put People First PA. And they are an organization that is nonpartisan. It is a non-ideological organization, and it's strictly based on, it strictly focuses on the needs of people across the state of Pennsylvania. And what we've done is we've chosen the campaign of healthcare as a human right to be our first campaign. And a lot of folks are like, well, right now in Pennsylvania, public education is the sort of big fight. But we realize that across the state, when you talk to folks, you find that the thing that people are hurting the most from is healthcare. And in a variety of ways. Some people are directly suffering from lack of access to healthcare, or maybe they have healthcare or health insurance, but their health insurance still doesn't, you know, it's still not comprehensive and it's too expensive. And then you have people who are indirectly hurting from lack of health insurance or healthcare, I should say. They have a family member who is really ill, and that person maybe has Medicare, but Medicare doesn't pay everything, and then they have rent on top of that. So there's all kinds of financial uncertainties with people that they love. And so they're like, well, I'm going to help them by giving them money. But, of course, that strains their household, and you can feel that there. And also healthcare is something that every single one of us, we need throughout the course of our life, not just when we get older, not just when we get sicker, but we need it now. We need it from birth all the way, you know, throughout our latter years.
Right. Because, like you say, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, somebody could be in an accident at the age of 3 and really look up hospital bill kind of thing. I mean, you just don't know. So it's important.
Sure.
And should be free, yes.
Mm-hmm. The other, other organization that I'm involved in, yes, I do, I am involved in like a Philadelphia coalition for a fight for public education, and that is an important fight, especially here in Philadelphia, where there's a really, really big push to basically charterize, if you will, the schools here in Philadelphia, and then eventually to privatize. That's sort of the strategy. And so one of the things is fighting for funding to schools, because I don't know if you've heard, but I think it was about 2 weeks ago, a young boy whose family had been homeless and without health care, mind you, he had a congenital heart defect, which family never knew about because they had no health care. And he went to school, and it looked like he had a heart attack as a result.
No, I didn't hear.
Say again?
No, I didn't hear about that. That's
it was a very sad story. You know, he had a heart attack, and the thing is, there was no nurse in the school because the school was only allowed to have a nurse twice a week. In most of the schools across the city of Philadelphia, we have you have a situation where there's a nurse, that one nurse is allowed to be there from, say, 12 o'clock in the afternoon to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they're gone. And that's not, it's not guaranteed that he or she will be there every single day. Most of the time, it's once a week or twice a week for a couple of hours. And that's part of the big budget cuts. Now, this little boy wasn't the first child to die as a result of lack of proper funding in the schools. Another young woman, LaPortia Massey, I think is her name, she also passed away from an asthma attack, and there was no nurse at the school because, you know, we can't afford to provide students with, you know, health service.
Oh.
Health professionals.
I mean, that's just sad. No. That's horrible. So you're working with an organization to try to change that.
Yeah, we're working with an organization to try to change that. And it's a coalition of different organizations that are involved. It's a tough fight. A lot of folks are focusing on getting the current governor out of office and having someone who is more favorable to public education. I think the fight needs to go much deeper than that, and we need to engage in some really deep and thorough community organizing to build the relationships and build the power of the people in the community so that they are, no matter who is in office, they can get what they need.
Right. Wow. Okay, well, that's good to me. I think that this is keeping you busy. And Bride, and your work, extra hours, and your organizations. So, in our last couple minutes, what kind of advice would you give to other people who want to get involved and they're not sure where to go?
The first thing I would say is, believe it or not, is to start. Excuse me, scratchy voice today. The first thing I would say is to start with your neighbor. And that sounds really, really cheesy. But I mean it in the sense that you need to talk to your neighbors to see and ask them what are their needs, like what are things that are going on in their lives that, you know, you can help with or that they would be willing to stand with someone else and strive to have met. That's really what we did. That's what we did with Put People First. We actually had a survey. We went door to door. We talked to people and we said, okay, you know, what are the needs that you have that are being met or not being met? And from that, that's how we were able to come up with the idea of healthcare. But what that also does, it means that we're breaking down those invisible barriers that we often put up that have also often been, you know, readily produced as a result of being in capitalistic society, right? That need to be isolated from other human beings and to be locked away from other people. So,
right, because I was just going to say, people used to, you know, sit on the front stoop or whatever. They worked with their neighbors. Now, they're socialized with them, and now we don't even know their names in many cases. So what you're saying is a good idea, definitely. Will you come back? Because our time is up. Will you come back in the not-too-distant future so we can continue?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Let me know when you want me on, and we'll get
okay.
out.
All right. Thank you so much, my friend, and again, congratulations, and say hi to your new bride. And then you and I'll set up a time real soon, and we'll get you back on. So
sounds good.
Thank you, and enjoy. I keep telling people, enjoy this full moon. It's the last Friday, the 13th full moon until 2049. So, hey. Make it.
I caught the tail end of that. That's what came on.
enjoy it. And we'll see you soon. Thank you so much.